From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein still has a job. Late this morning, there was a question about that, reporting that he told a source he feared he was going to be fired after he was called to the White House because of that explosive New York Times story on Friday that last year Rosenstein discussed secretly recording President Trump and invoking the 25th Amendment to remove him from office in the chaotic days after FBI Director James Comey was fired. Then later in the morning, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said in a statement to CNN that President Trump, who's in New York for the UN General Assembly, had an extended conversation on the phone with Rosenstein about recent news stories, and that Trump plans to meet with Rosenstein on Thursday when the president is back in Washington.
Of course, Rosenstein, a very important figure because he's been overseeing the Mueller investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, potential collusion by the Trump campaign, and potential obstruction of justice by President Trump. So what to make of all of this? Rick Klein is political director at ABC News. He's with us. Hi, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
And first of all, what is the latest on Rod Rosenstein's job? It sounds like he's got it for now.
He just left the White House moments ago, shook hands with the White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly, and he's back at the Department of Justice being the Deputy Attorney General. He does have a job. We know from the White House that he and President Trump have had a conversation about that rather explosive story that came out late last week, but that they're not going to have a more full discussion until Thursday, the day that President Trump is back from the UN General Assembly. Also, coincidentally, the day that Judge Kavanaugh is going to have his hearing on Capitol Hill. So Thursday is looking
Is that a coincidence, or does President Trump want some way to take the news focus away from that Kavanaugh hearing if it happens on Thursday?
Well, it is his first day back.
Yeah, but he does have to come back.
Exactly. It's his first day back in town, so you gave him the benefit of the doubt there. But it is going to be quite a cataclysmic day, potentially, in Washington, where all these different forces come together. And whether the president wants to make a change at the top of the Department of Justice at the same time that his Supreme Court nominee is undergoing a tough grilling in his road to a confirmation, it makes for quite a scene, and it just adds to a general sense of uncertainty and unease in Washington around the state of affairs in the Trump administration.
And by the way, we're going to get to more questions about the latest news about Kavanaugh, but you say unease, and as we well know, President Trump, this is a way to operate. This, you know, he enjoys, and I said he enjoys sort of the chaos, but this morning, we got a taste of what might be happening. This high drama of all the cable news cameras focused on this wet driveway, it's raining, in Washington, hoping to catch a glimpse of Rosenstein coming to this meeting that he was summoned to. What do you think his chances are? You know, yes, he exited with his job, but it still feels kind of ominous. Remind us, you know, what the president can do, what a president can do with a deputy attorney general.
He could fire him. He serves at the will of the president. It's a little different than Mueller himself. He couldn't fire Mueller directly. He could order the person that oversees him, Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general in this instance, to fire him, but he may not follow through with that. But no, this man serves at the pleasure of the president. He could fire Rod Rosenstein, and that would cause utter chaos up and down the federal government, starting with the Mueller probe. We've already heard from the president's attorneys this morning saying if there was a change in leadership at the deputy attorney general overseeing the investigation, they'd want to pause on the entire probe. We don't know where Mueller is. We don't know that another person overseeing that investigation would allow the same leeway, the same budget, the same maneuverability that Mueller seems to have enjoyed this time. We really don't have any insight. In fact, that new person could decide to never reveal what Mueller decides to come up with at the end. So it throws everything into doubt. And of course, the president has been warring openly with his attorney general, Rod Rosenstein's boss, Jeff Sessions, even saying last week that he really doesn't have an attorney general.
Well, and
to his mind, not doing
I just want
job.
To follow up on that, because there was also a moment a couple of weeks ago where Jeff Sessions was called to the White House and there was a huge flurry of concern that he was going to be fired. He wasn't. And yet people today have been invoking the Watergate era and Nixon firing or, you know, forcing to resign attorney general, then a deputy attorney general who wouldn't fire a special prosecutor then. So there has been precedent for this. And the president fired acting attorney general Sally Yates because she didn't agree with his immigration policy at that time. So this obviously is something that can happen.
Yeah, the Saturday Night Massacre could happen on a Monday morning. It could happen any time the president wants it to happen, or not at all. And it may be just keeping people a little uneasy about it is where things stand. A lot of folks that I've talked to in Washington have assumed that Rod Rosenstein and Jeff Sessions both would be fired, but not until after the November election.
Where do we stand, Rick, on Brett Kavanaugh, the Supreme Court nominee? There's now another allegation of sexual misconduct against him, this one about his time when he was a student at Yale in the 1980s. We know that there's going to be this hearing on Thursday with Christine Blasey Ford, the first accuser, who is saying that she was sexually assaulted by Brett Kavanaugh when they were in high school together many decades ago. President Trump and Republicans seem still to be standing by him. How do you see this playing out?
Well, it's not clear yet whether this hearing is going to go forward with full cooperation. Christine Blasey Ford did accept the invitation to testify, and Judge Kavanaugh has as well. Democrats were on board. And then this other story broke that you referenced in The New Yorker last night. Now, Democrats are saying the whole process should be delayed. But whether or not this goes forward, it is full steam ahead from this White House for this nominee. Their view is that Judge Kavanaugh is being smeared here, that he deserves the opportunity to clear his name. And they believe they still have a path to getting him the votes to confirmation. I think the thing that would change that would be some other piece of evidence coming forward corroborating some of the allegations. Right now, the women involved, the two women that are making allegations, are the only witnesses that will speak to them directly. Or beyond that, just a collapse in political support. And that could happen before Thursday or after.
Do you think that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, looks at this and says, I'm not going to go that far for Brett Kavanaugh? It's between him getting confirmed or my majority in the Senate. I'm going to stick up for my majority in the Senate.
I don't think anyone who knows Mitch McConnell would question where he would side if it came down to that. I also don't think we're there yet. Mitch McConnell does care deeply about his majority. He knows where the votes are. And if he has a sense that they won't get the votes or that taking the vote could endanger congressional control of the Senate, then I think he might go in another direction and start urging the president there. But you heard from him on Friday saying to keep the faith that that Judge Kavanaugh would become Justice Kavanaugh. And again, he knows his members better than anyone.
Well, and Rick, you write in your note, which is great. We tell direct people to it. But very briefly, you write how Republicans have also seemed to have a deaf ear on this. In one case, somebody making a joke about Ruth Bader Ginsburg being, pawed by President Lincoln or something like that. There seems to be a tone deafness that they have to avoid.
And I think the real danger for Republicans is how you handle this moment, because it is bigger than politics. It's a societal moment. It's something that women are grappling with across realms. And to see politicians deal with it and to see Kavanaugh linger out there, it makes for a lot of uncomfortable political conversations.
Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
Well, the Kavanaugh hearings are on the minds of many Americans around the country. So we sent reporters out to speak with some potential voters yesterday, which was before the latest allegations of sexual misconduct against Kavanaugh were reported. First, we hear from some people in Louisville, Kentucky.
I'm Adam McClish. I'm 37. I live in Louisville, Kentucky. I am an accountant. I think he should be elected to the Supreme Court, but I think that they need to slow everything down, not fast track it. But at the same time, I think something that you do when you're 18 shouldn't necessarily destroy your career 30 years down the line.
Dodie Flaherty, 78 years old, Louisville, and I'm a homemaker. I think they should just go ahead and confirm me. I mean, that hearing's fine, but what upsets me more than anything is that the delay. I just don't think it's fair to him. He's a good man, and we all do things, and I don't believe it.
Shelly Lentine, I am 65. I live in Middletown, Kentucky, and I'm retired. I would like to see him confirmed if, in fact, the allegations against him are not true.
And if they are?
No, I'm not confirmed.
My full name is Dana Kreft. My age is 38. I live in Germantown, Kentucky, and I am a property manager. As a Democrat, I am a very, very, very liberal person that I feel that there's been too much secrecy, and we haven't been given all of the facts. The fact that we were given all the paperwork the night before, didn't have much time to look over it. I feel anything right now, we can just kind of put a hold on it, and let's see what any other options are out there.
So that was Louisville, Kentucky. Here is Sioux City, Iowa.
I'm Wendy DeLutri. I'm 62. I live in Peterson, Iowa, and I'm a hairdresser. I'm just concerned about some of the way he thinks, some of his judgments. I think they need to slow it down and look at all, not jump into any decisions too fast about appointing him. Take more time.
James Saylor. I'm 68. Schleswig, Iowa. I'm a farmer. I think they should complete it and move on and confirm him before time runs out. The Democrats don't want it to ever end. They want to drag it out till after the midterms.
My name is Ryan Barnes. I'm 31. I'm from Sioux City, Iowa, and I'm a construction worker. I want a fair hearing for the accuser. I believe she should have a fair hearing, not just with Republicans, but Republicans and Democrats. The same amount of people in the room. And I believe the FBI should be there, too, because at some point it's a criminal case in my mind. And I think in most people's mind, it's a criminal case. If he's out there doing it, then he shouldn't be a part of the Supreme Court.
Some voices of citizens there in Sioux City, Iowa, and Louisville, Kentucky. We'd love to hear from you as well. You can weigh in at hereandnow.org. And we will be watching on Thursday when Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford are set to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee.
About 6,000 to 8,000 residents of Georgetown County, South Carolina, are preparing to evacuate because up to 10 feet of water from rivers swollen by Hurricane Florence is expected to flood that area tomorrow. In North Carolina, 5 rivers remain at major flood stage levels. And when rivers crest and cross their banks, they will, in many places, flood farmland. There have already been reports that flooding has caused breaches at some large lagoons where hog waste is stored. This is a long-term problem. We'll take it up at another time. But what else are farmers facing? Scott Marlowe is a farm crisis advocate based in North Carolina and senior policy specialist at the nonprofit RAFI. That's the Rural Advancement Foundation International. He's helped farmers recover from 17 hurricanes, including Florence. And Scott, before Florence hit, you were worried about crops still in the ground. So what happened?
It's very extensive, and there's still, obviously, folks are still getting in to understand the extent of the damage. Most of our peanut crop and sweet potato crop was still in the field. Both of them are underground, so sitting underwater for long periods of time is very, very damaging. You know, most of our cotton crop was still in the field. Most of the soybean crop was still in the field. A pretty large percentage of tobacco was still in the field. All of those. You know, the wind that came in with the hurricane is one thing. It blows crops down. It lays them down. But the flooding is even more damaging and even more complete a damage to the to the crops and, you know, makes them unharvestable.
So what happens? Because the water's sitting there. It's going to be sitting there, we understand, for days. And it's still coming. These rivers are still cresting. So talk about how farmers, when they have these huge losses, how they might get reimbursed. First of all, you go in. And your people go in and you literally sit with farmers and count receipts and shoeboxes, you've said. But if farmers don't do something, if they don't do something within a certain window, they're out of luck.
Well, one of the big messages that we get out to folks is that the first thing that they need to do is to document all of their disaster, all of the disaster losses. Because government programs often can come online a year, even 2 years after the disaster to pay for losses. But if they haven't documented them, they can't get access to those programs. You know, disaster recovery for anyone requires them to be at their most organized best at a point where their life and their, you know, their brain and everything is at its worst. Their situation is at its worst. And so there's a whole series of different programs. They often have different deadlines and different applications. They have to navigate between FEMA and the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Small Business Administration. They have to know which agency covers which damage, and that's their real differences there, but it's very difficult. There are some great people who are out there, even as we speak, helping people evacuate, helping people in shelters and doing that. What we're working on getting in place is the longer term recovery for exactly that, is sitting down with people, working through the paperwork with them, helping go through the application process. It's very important because these deadlines are going to start coming up 30, 60, 90 days after the disaster. And, you know, it's very difficult to be that kind of organized and get all your paperwork together. You know, it's hard to document how much production that you had when your file cabinets are, you know, a waterlogged mess.
Right, which is why you tell farmers to take photographs before the storm hits so that they have pictures as well. But talk about the difference in insurance coverage they might get. And this is where we get into the, it can get kind of netty, but the difference between commodity farms that are just, you know, selling goods back to, let's say, maybe big companies, and special direct marketing farms, something you're encouraging people who might be, let's say, raising grass-fed cows to sell them directly as kind of a specialty to people. Those farmers who might lose cows or lose that grass, you know, that is going to feed those cows, they're going to get reimbursed the same as the commodity farmer who might have, you know, cows all, you know, in sort of an industrial situation. They're not going to get the same return on what they put in.
The main federal program for production losses is federal crop insurance. It's subsidized by the taxpayer. It's available to farmers. And like all insurance, the larger the commodity or the larger the crop, the more they're able to provide effective insurance. And so your corn, soy, cotton, they have pretty extensive crop insurance policies. Now, I got to be clear, just like your health insurance or your car insurance, that doesn't mean that those insurance policies make those farmers whole. It means that they have something that they know they're going to get a certain percentage of their return back. They're still going to struggle. They're still going to have a hard time. And the returns on those commodities are very thin. But if you're doing something specialty, and increasingly consumers are looking for local or specialty raised, that's a much higher value. So the farmer's going to invest more in producing it. And then that product is going to have a higher value in the marketplace. The things that you're going to buy at a specialty grocery store, you know, heirloom tomatoes or any of those types of things. Well, for those farmers, the prices that are set in the insurance policies aren't going to come anywhere near the value of their product in the marketplace. The value of that product can be two or three times. And so what we've seen over the last few years, especially in North Carolina with the reduction of tobacco production, is farmers moving into very high value, often direct markets, sales to restaurants, sales to high value grocery stores, and real entrepreneurship, great entrepreneurship from the farm community to drive that. Well, those are the exact farmers who are going to have the most difficulty recovering, because the disaster programs are just not geared for that type of production, for that value, to really address those kinds of losses. And so, you know, we've worked a lot of different, you know, it's my 17th hurricane. And what we see is that for the large scale producers, I mean, they're going to have a tough time, but they're going to get on through. For those smaller scale and mid scale folks who are selling something higher value, it's going to be very, very difficult. Yeah. They're just not going to have the same safety net.
In the meantime, we understand you're keeping an eye on the hemp crop. Mid-sized farmers in North Carolina think this is the next big thing. North Carolina is moving ahead of the federal government in allowing hemp production. How did the hemp crop fare?
I'm hearing from a series of folks. This was a year where we had a significant jump in production. A lot of small and mid-scale farms really got into it, seeing that it's something that they want to go after, a new market. But one of the important pieces is that that's a crop that is completely off of the safety net. There is no insurance for it. There's no backup for those production losses, for the value of those production losses. It can be very expensive to put in. Folks who've taken that risk are really looking at major losses. Those who had it in the field were hearing losses of anywhere from half to all of the hemp that was out there. And there's really not any place that they can get those losses covered. They're going to have to absorb that. Yeah. And so that's one of the risks of moving into a high-value crop that doesn't have that kind of safety net behind it.
Yeah. Look, you talk about how you're obviously looking now to see the damage to crops, the damage to farms. But you say right after a storm, banks, let's say, that farmers might have to make constant payments to, farmers have to constantly borrow money to, you know, do their work every season. Banks are a little more sympathetic. But in a couple of years, we might start seeing the foreclosures.
The pattern that we see is that folks will pull it all together to get through and go another year and get through this time. But what a disaster does is it takes all of the resilience out of the farm. So all of their savings, all their retirement, anything that they had extra, everything's gone. And they've spent so much time and they've spent so much money trying to recover. And so what happens is, as they go forward, they can't afford to stub their toe. It's important to note that we were already in a very, very low price commodity situation already. Nationally, farm income is down by 50%. Our hotline already had a very full caseload before we hit the hurricane. So as they go forward, what we see frequently is that the foreclosures and the problems will really kick in 2 years, 3 years, even 4 years down the line after the attention on the hurricane or the attention on the disaster has gone away. And when they're still trying, they're in that very dangerous window of having no reserves and carrying extra debt and not having had the time to make up for it and get back on their feet and really go forward again.
Mm. Well, we hope that a couple years down the road you don't see that, but historically that's what you have seen. That's Scott Marlowe, a farm crisis advocate and senior policy specialist at RAFI. That's the nonprofit Rural Advancement Foundation International. He has responded to help farmers after 17 hurricanes now. And Scott, what's the spirit there?
I think one of the really important things is that we tend to look at people as either helpers or victims. And, you know, I was talking to a farmer yesterday who is a member of his volunteer fire department. He's looking at having lost 700 acres of peanuts, but he's out doing water rescues this week. So it's really important as people get back on their feet that, you know, the folks who are going through this, they're all going through it together. And people who are helping are also going through it. So as we go forward over time, we know that this is going to play out and be tough in terms of mental health, in terms of people's health, physical health, in terms of the resilience of their households and their farms. And it's just a very important time for people to stick together and take care of each other and be in it and take care of each other for the long haul. This is going to take years for us to get past. It's not going to happen in a couple of months. It's going to keep going long after the attention has gone someplace else.
Well, Scott, best of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
He gives us a deeper appreciation of our sweet potatoes.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Putting a freeze on your credit just got a lot cheaper. A new law went into effect on Friday in response to last year's data breach at Equifax that exposed 148 million people to identity theft. Used to be, if consumers thought they were a victim, they could pay a fee to stop lenders from pulling a credit report for new credit cards or car loans. Well, now you can do it for free. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
So first of all, what does it mean to freeze your credit and why would you do it?
A credit freeze basically restricts all access to your credit file. That means with any of these big credit monitoring services. And what it really does is it locks down your credit both for identity thieves, but also for you. So either they or you are prevented from opening a new account, meaning being able to borrow either for a credit card or an auto loan or even a house. And what you really need to know is that right now, as you said, it's free to freeze and unfreeze, but the process is still kind of time consuming. You know, you have to go to each of the credit bureau's websites, answer some questions, get a PIN, and then each time you want to freeze or unfreeze your account, you may not have to pay a fee, but you still have a headache of having to go through the process.
So why would you want to do it?
You know, it is the safest way to lock down your credit. I did this, I believe we spoke about it a year ago after the Equifax breach. I did it for myself. I did it for my girlfriend and for the mother-in-law and for the mother and every single person in my family. And you know what? As long as you don't need access to new credit, it's a really safe way to ensure that nobody's poking around in your credit file. But again, that's a big caveat because, frankly, a lot of people do need to have loans, so they can't afford to keep their files permanently shut down.
There's also something called a fraud alert, though. What is that?
Well, an alert tells any business that runs your credit that they should take an extra step and check with you before opening an account. But, you know, I speak to data security experts. They say it's just a teeny tiny road bump. So really, the most important thing is that a freeze is a much safer way to proceed. I should say that another feature of the new law that went into effect on Friday is that fraud alerts will last for up to 1 year. That's up from 90 days previously.
Now, the data breach that you mentioned at Equifax put nearly half of the U.S. population at risk of identity theft, social security numbers, date of birth, credit card numbers, all exposed. Is making a credit freeze free meaningful reform for a big problem?
You know, I don't think it is really. I think it's better. I do believe that idea of paying $10 to $30 every time you freeze and unfreeze was some barrier. Also, there's a barrier that it can take a few days to unfreeze your credit if you do need access. But I think the bigger problem is that really, when you talk to security experts, they say you have to remember you're not the customer. You are the product. Your data is the product. And, you know, ideally what should happen, people should be born with their credit frozen. So parents get a social security number for their newborns. The child should basically live his or her young life with frozen credit. Later, when they need the credit, you would have to unfreeze it. Of course, I think that the banks would go completely insane if you actually had that idea go into effect. So I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. But remember, the onus is on you.
And this new law, by the way, does allow you to freeze your child's credit.
Yes, and you absolutely should for all children under age 16.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News. Thank you.
Take care.
Two months after the Trump administration was ordered to reunite every migrant family separated at the U.S.-Mexico border, more than 400 families remain separated. USA Today immigration reporter Alan Gomez joins us now with more on this story. Hi, Alan.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And is there a path for getting those remaining families back together?
It appears that there is in many of these cases. The two sides, the government lawyers and the ACLU attorneys and their team of volunteers on the ground in Central America have been working overtime in recent weeks and are going to continue to do so. And they, on both sides, expect this process to be done, they say, now within a few more weeks. I mean, it's been more than 2 months since the judge first ordered this, so it's taken some time, but during a hearing last week, they both sounded like they were pretty confident and pretty excited that they were approaching the finish line.
And for those families that are still not reunited with each other, the parents in many cases have applied for asylum and some of them were denied asylum.
Exactly. And so now we have they're getting close to finishing that connection of reestablishing contact between all of the separated families. But now we have multiple things that will start. In one case, the judge has ordered that as many as 1,000 of these cases need to be reexamined. They need to do the asylum application all over again because, as the judge ruled, they were separated at the time, so it's kind of hard to make your case for asylum when your child's not there. And so in a lot of these cases, we're starting from scratch. They're going to start over, go through the initial interview again, and to determine if there is a, quote, credible fear that they fear returning to their home country. But for others, it's just a matter of just finalizing the process of either reuniting them with their families or just agreeing to be separated. It's a lot of moving parts, and it's all going on at the same time.
Do they really have a better shot of getting asylum this time around?
I don't know if they have a better shot. They do have a shot. There was an agreement brokered between the government and the ACLU attorneys who filed this suit, ordering that they have to do this. And one of the things that the government has to do now is they must consider the, quote, psychological state of the parent at the time of their initial interview. And that's legalese for they were pretty traumatized because their children had been taken away from them. In this case, unlike the first time around, a lawyer must be present or they must have the opportunity to have a lawyer either in person or on the telephone. unlike before. Even deported parents are going to be allowed to testify by phone, and in some extreme cases may be allowed to return to the U.S. to do so in person. So there's a lot of factors that are building up in favor of these families to get a better hearing, but it remains unclear whether that will lead to, you know, hundreds of overturned cases and they suddenly all get allowed to stay, or if it's going to be the same result, just with a fairer and a more robust process behind it.
Meanwhile, the latest Customs and Border Protection data show that dramatically more families are arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. But the Trump administration is standing by its zero-tolerance policy. Here is Attorney General Jeff Sessions speaking earlier this month.
No great and prosperous nation can have both a generous welfare system and great prosperity and open borders. Such a policy is both radical, it's dangerous.
So is the surge of border arrests a sign that zero tolerance is not working, that people are still trying to come here?
The original intent behind all of this, family separations, the zero tolerance policy, was to deter people from coming. Now we're seeing record numbers of families coming over. So if you just draw that straight line, it appears that it is not working. You know, people throughout Central America, trust me, they follow all these developments very closely. And so they're aware of the public, of the family separations. They hear Attorney General Sessions' comments, but they're still coming in record numbers. We were speaking with the Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection just last week, and he said for the first time, more than 50% of the people being apprehended along the border are family units. Traditionally in the U.S., it's been single adults coming mostly from Mexico and in some cases Central America. But this wave has only continued to increase. So we don't see any slowdown whatsoever. And now it's a question of whether the administration tries to do anything else to deter them from coming.
How do you make sense of that, that there are so many family units coming?
I mean, it's really difficult to tell because on the one hand, they're aware of the fact that a federal judge has thrown out the family separation portion of this. So that might indicate to them, hey, we got a shot. But as somebody who's been in Central America quite a bit and visited these places in Honduras and El Salvador, and I've seen firsthand just how omnipresent that threat of violence is down there. And talking to so many of these people who are coming from those countries, it's very clear that a lot of them really do fear for their lives that much in their home countries. The Trump administration will tell you that most of these are frauds, so these are just people trying to sneak into the country any way that they can. But I've just heard the same story from too many people and seen it firsthand too often to completely disregard the fact that a lot of these people are truly, truly terrified for staying in their home countries and are coming here to try to just get some basic level of security.
There's one more thing I want to ask you about. The Department of Homeland Security issued a draft rule over the weekend that would restrict green cards for people who are accepting public assistance like food stamps or Section 8 vouchers. Now, this is subject to a 60-day review period, but tell us more about this and what's going on here.
Yeah, I mean, we spend so much time talking about the Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigration that sometimes it's hard to see just how many ways they're trying to limit legal immigration as well. And this is one of those cases and a massive one because this could end up affecting millions of people trying to enter this country. In short, before, and it's been longstanding U.S. policy that someone who's deemed a public charge cannot be admitted into the country for a green card, and that was defined as somebody who was primarily dependent on the government to survive in this country. What this new rule would do is say if you've accepted any public benefits in the past, now or in the future, you are likely to become a public charge, and so you do not get your green card and you do not get your extension for visas and things like that. So before, if you received cash from the government in the form of like Social Security, that would disqualify you. Now, if you use food stamps, Section 8 housing, other federal housing assistance, Medicare Part D, if you use any sort of government assistance moving forward, you will likely be deemed inadmissible. Like you said, this is something that's going to, it's going to be several months before it goes into effect, but just the fact that they've proposed this rule has thrown immigration advocacy groups, they're all very nervous right now about what this could mean for the future of millions of people trying to get into this country.
Alan, we are just weeks away from the midterm elections. What's your sense, based on your reporting, of where Latinos stand right now? Are they preparing to go out and vote in one direction or the other? Are they really angered by the family separation policy, et cetera?
any immigrant who's been in this country for multiple generations is going to view something like illegal immigration as something to be suspicious about. But what's changed in the past year under this administration is that they've gone after so many avenues of legal immigration. So trying to reduce things like the refugee program, the asylum process, and those family separations were something that really, really inflamed groups that have traditionally, I've spoken to, been very supportive of efforts to crack down on illegal immigration. But when they saw that, they said, okay, that's a really big step too far. And I think it really kind of inflamed a lot of folks, both Latin voters and just regular American voters and white voters and native-born voters, to really get them upset at that policy. That's really kind of been an eyebrow raiser for a lot of moderate supporters of the president's agenda. And the more he does when it comes to refugees, when it comes to asylum seekers, a lot of folks I've spoken to have said, hey, I signed up for a border wall. I signed up for trying to cut down on illegal immigration, but I didn't sign up for all this other stuff. So I think that's what's really getting a lot of people upset. And I'm hearing a lot more enthusiasm to get out there and vote.
Because traditionally, Latinos tend not to vote in as big numbers as they represent in the country, right?
Exactly. Hispanics have always underperformed compared to white voters, compared to black voters, even when there are big topics of immigration in an election year. But in this year, we have so many things lined up. We have the president still trying to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA. We have the family separation crisis over the summer. We had the travel ban last year. They've done so many big things that Republicans believe, or at least the Trump administration believes, are winning issues, are things that are going to drive more Republicans out to the polls. But the more of them that they do, they also risk getting more Democrats out to the polls and more moderates going out and voting against them because of how many things they're trying to do.
It's Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, thank you.
Jeremy, thanks for having me.
And now we want to take a moment to consider the eggplant. It's not just from Parmesan anymore, although we have a terrific recipe from our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, who also has some other eggplant treats. I think one is going to be my new favorite thing, but we'll get to that. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Robin. So you blew the lead.
That we got something great. But eggplant Parmesan does get a bad reputation, doesn't it?
Well, there's a reason for that. Generally, when you order it, it's soaked in oil, it's been fried, it's breaded and breadcrumbs, there's heavy amounts of cheese, mm-hmm. and it's gloppy.
Yeah.
And it's like, where's the eggplant? Where's the flavor? It seems to be all about oil. But there are several ways to avoid that.
Well, I have to say, in defense of the gloppy eggplant, I do love that too. It's some, you know, sometimes you get
it's a classic.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a classic. But here's what I did.
What'd you do?
So imagine eggplant like a sponge. When you cut it open, that spongy texture, when you want to saute it in a little bit of oil because you want to keep it healthy, it just sucks up all that oil, and then you have to add more. The way to get around that, for me, is I roast an eggplant whole. So you take an entire eggplant, you wrap it in foil, you put it in a 400-degree oven for anywhere from 20 to 40 minutes. Then you can slice it, and then I interspersed it with the last tomatoes of the season. You could also use your favorite tomato sauce, a slice of mozzarella, a slice of fresh basil, and I keep repeating. Mm. There's a very little bit of olive oil on the bottom of the dish, but otherwise, all that flavor that you're tasting is from the tomatoes and eggplant and the cheese.
And not the oil.
Didn't
you used to have to, I can remember making eggplant Parmesan, and you'd have to slice it and dry it and put paper towels
on
it.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up. That is the other issue. That is the bitterness issue. And this is what turns a lot of people off from eggplant. The first thing to say about this is if you buy eggplant at a farmer's market or you get it from a friend's garden, it will go straight through the fall. It's not going to be bitter because it's fresh. Mm. The bitterness develops with age. So that's tip number one. The second way to deal with it is salt. You cut it in half or into the shape that you want for your dish, put it into a colander, sprinkle it liberally with salt, and you put a plate on top with a can of soup or a can of broth, and you weigh it down. And what happens is all the bitter juices are released.
Not what we were doing.
But that's an extra step, and the roasting is so much healthier. And I don't know, if you can avoid salting something and waiting around a half an hour, I say more power to you.
Okay. Here we have, looks like a ratatouille. What's this?
It's actually a caponata, which is a classic Italian recipe. It's like a relish or a condiment, and I absolutely love this. You roast the eggplant, right? Uh-huh. So much flavor happening there. And then you heat some olive oil, onion, garlic, chopped red and green peppers.
It's sweet.
It is sweet because the eggplant's sweet. You add fresh tomatoes, which are sweet, and then it's got raisins in it and olives in it. And so there's sweet and savory going on. And this is delicious just with crackers and cheese plate. It's wonderful with pasta, actually. People serve it with grilled fish or shrimp and also with grilled meats.
Okay, now...
Now for your favorite recipe.
And I can't believe, because that last one, that might have been number one, except, oh my God.
Except this one.
What would you call this?
I call it eggplant curry, and it's like a Thai green curry. Again, I roasted the eggplant, and then I made a curry, which I have to say, I just made up on the spot, and I was like, oh, I feel the same way. I'm like, I want to eat this a lot.
Hire that woman.
Right. It's oil and ginger and onion and garlic. And then I added some green Thai curry paste to it. And it's got scallions. And, of course, it's got coconut milk. And that's where you get that delicious richness. And I served it over brown rice, which has got that wonderful nutty texture.
Wow. And can you get that stuff everywhere, the curry paste and everything? Can you everywhere?
It's in my supermarket in Maine, so I say yes, it's everywhere. Okay. Yeah, and a lot of cilantro and scallions on top.
Quick question. Some people avoid eggplant and tomatoes and things because they say they're part of the nightshade family.
They are a nightshade.
They call them deadly nightshade, and they say it gives them arthritis and pain.
Yeah, it's really inconclusive medical evidence. People with certain types of arthritis, like rheumatoid arthritis, report a worsening of symptoms like swelling and joint pain after they eat nightshades. I have many friends who have rheumatoid arthritis and live on tomatoes and eggplants, which are both nightshades. So it's something to think about if that's part of your medical life. But I don't think this eggplant's going to hurt you in any way. It's going to make you feel kind of great.
Well, as usual, talk to your doctor about
that. Talk to your doctor. Eat it in moderation.
Meantime, buying an eggplant, how do you...
Yes, firm, heavy in your hand. It should feel weighty. The skin should be glossy and bright. There shouldn't be any bruising or scars.
And how long can they keep?
They'll keep for a good week, 10 days. You want to keep them refrigerated. But again, if we have learned that bitterness develops with age, you want to buy them fresh, cook them quickly.
In eggplants. In eggplants. Not people.
I'm not referencing any hosts of Here and Now here, okay? I'm not referencing myself. No, we're speaking about eggplant, which are also called aubergine or garden egg or brinjal.
And they're wonderful. You've outdone yourself. A resident chef, Kathy Gunst. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
And we'll have more information about eggplants as well as these terrific recipes at hereandnow.org.
Nice to have a little break from Washington news.
Yes, and you've been taking notes, I saw. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.